this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
There seems to be this idea now that the only way for the US to win this huge geopolitical conflict that it has with China specifically, and to a lesser extent Russia, is to drag everyone to war.
Nigerian journalist, author, filmmaker, and African Stream contributor David Undayan explains the technology used to wage information warfare in Africa.
We shouldn't look at ourselves as African-Americans, Afro-Latino, Afro-Caribbean. We are just stolen Africans, like the comedian Paul Mooney used to say, that consolidates Africa's efforts in this hemisphere. This is what they're afraid of.
We'll hear from Obi Aguna of the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association on the recent developments in the African world, as well as Cuba and Venezuela.
We've been abandoned by our state government, by the federal government. You know, we've been screwed every step along the way. And yesterday was just another example of how they're doing nothing for us.
A federal court in Ohio approves a settlement of the East Palestine rail catastrophe, but doesn't provide health care for the residents and workers. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. On September 13, Secretary of State Antony Blinken held a press conference in which he accused the Russian media outlet RT of covertly disseminating Kremlin-produced content and messaging, not only in the U.S., but also in Africa and other parts of the world. In particular, he singled out African Stream, a Pan-African media platform distributed via its website, africanstream.media, and on social media platforms. Shortly after Blinken's press conference, African Stream was banned by YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and even TikTok, which is most likely under State Department pressure and in fear of losing their large U.S. market. I spoke to Nigerian journalist, author, filmmaker, and African Stream contributor David Undayan about the technology used to wage information warfare in Africa.
The vast majority of African internet access is mobile internet. So most Africans don't really have wired broadband, you know, that sort of thing. It's mobile internet, 3G, 4G, to a lesser extent, 5G.
Primarily via cell phones.
Yes.
Okay. And again, 93% of Africans have cell phones. I was in Ethiopia a couple of years ago, and I noticed that most everyone had a cell phone. I mean, you'd see people driving donkey carts who would pull a cell phone in their pocket. Seems to be the first piece of technology that people would buy once they could afford it.
100%.
So how can this be controlled? How can the U.S. ultimately control mobile information?
Short answer, it can't. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to try. There seems to be this idea now that the only way for the U.S. to win this huge geopolitical conflict that it has with China specifically, and to a lesser extent Russia, is to drag everyone to war. The U.S. seems to have given up on the idea of outcompeting everyone else, like it supposedly did for decades or centuries. It's got the idea into its head that the only solution to everything now is war. And as I said earlier, before you can start a war, you need to sort of craft a narrative that gives you the justification to go to war. So a very clear example of this, for example, is the Israeli military campaign in Gaza. The information ecosystem that was curated around this thing makes it such that the vast majority of the Western audience, at least at the time of the invasion, I don't know about now, but at least at the time of the invasion, the vast majority of the Western audience was very much in favor of Israeli military action, because the message that was put out was that this terrible thing called October 7 happened, right? What that population was not made to understand was that October 7 itself can be contextualized as part of something else that has been going on for 76 years, right? And that's how information warfare works. And that information, that particular application of information warfare was very successful. It's actually still very successful, because up until now, somehow, across most of major global media, the consensus still remains that regardless of whatever atrocities the Israelis commit in Gaza or in Lebanon or in the West Bank or wherever, that somehow, by default, the Israelis are still the victims. Meanwhile, there's 70-something odd years of data showing otherwise. But that's how information warfare works. So the US seems to be of the idea that we may not necessarily be able to control all of the information like we once did, but the parts of the information that we can control that will give us the justification to go to war and basically bomb everyone back to the Stone Age so that we can once again regain our position as like the undisputed, unchallenged global hegemon. That type of information warfare is something that we have the capacity to enact. So I believe that's what all of this is about. It's a strategic targeting of specific voices and platforms that have the ability to destroy the narratives that will provide cover for war. There are a lot of media organizations and platforms that are sort of anti-American. The US doesn't normally go after them. The US doesn't normally acknowledge them. But the ones that it specifically goes after are the ones that are either anti-war, anti-imperialist, or especially in this instance, Pan-Africanist. Because for whatever reason, the idea of Pan-Africanism is something that has always just made the US government absolutely lose its marbles. The idea of Black people on both sides of the Atlantic coming together into some sort of political union absolutely terrifies the American establishment. Only they can explain why. But historically, that's always been the case. And it seems like even now, that has not changed. So good luck to them. I don't think it's going to work, but it doesn't mean that they're not going to try.
Okay. In the United States, Americans feel so much that they have a right to free speech. I think this is the explanation. The U.S. has been more gradual than it has, say, in Europe. Your ISP doesn't block you from getting access to RT, but they did shut down RT and Sputnik on broadcast outlets. Right. So you say here in this tweet, what if I told you that your African ISP in your African country will soon be subject by 1 or 2 degrees of separation to Americans' laws forcing them to stop giving you access to certain information? Now, we're talking ISP, what people use to access information on their computers, right?
Yeah, internet service provider. So basically your mobile network.
Well, but that's not your phone network, is it?
In the African context, it is, yes.
It is. Okay, you said earlier that you didn't think that was going to work, but you're saying that your African ISP will soon be subject to 2 degrees of separation. Tell us what that means.
So I forget the exact, there was a House piece of legislation that was passed in the House, something about AI. So if you listen to Blinken's press briefing on Friday, 13th of September, he actually made reference to it when he said that the US is building a more robust global information system. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what he was referencing. This bill basically seeks to make it such that under the guise of promoting facts and fighting misinformation and disinformation, basically the US government should have some sort of involvement and control over what content is allowed to be hosted on social media and across the internet, what content should be promoted or that people should be permitted to see. Mm-hmm. So generally speaking, the point of this bill was that the US government wants to make it such that if anyone is putting up something on the internet, which for whatever reason, the US government does not approve of, mm-hmm. then this information should either be prevented from being posted altogether mm-hmm. or should be removed when it's posted and there should be punitive measures applied to the poster, or at the very least, the information should be algorithmically suppressed, which, by the way, is something that happens on Twitter already a lot, mm-hmm. where accounts like mine, like I have over 1 million followers on Twitter. Right. Generally speaking, up until maybe 3 months ago, I would tweet absolutely anything. And the minimum number of views I'd get on a tweet is something like 300,000, the absolute minimum. Mm-hmm. More often than not, it was anything from 800,000 to 1 million plus. Mm-hmm. Right. More often than not. And mm-hmm. ever since, I guess, I came to the notice of the US government, uh-huh. I've just noticed that this has absolutely fallen off a cliff. Right. So even the tweets that you're referencing, the long tweet that you read, right. I think it had something like 400,000 views. That uh-huh. sort of tweet 4 months ago, if I posted that tweet, you have nothing less than 2 million, nothing less than that. Wow. So it's a thing called algorithmic suppression, where when your account has been flagged or when a specific account has been flagged, the ability of the stuff that is put out by that account to reach people is artificially suppressed. So you're not being censored in that your account is not being restricted, you're not being deleted, you're still free to say what you want, but it's just that not many people are going to see it. So if on average, right, you put out something and half million people are seeing it, a million people are seeing it, now you put out something and maybe like 30,000 people are seeing it, 20,000 people are seeing it. So in theory, you're not being censored, but in effect, you are being censored, right? And this is one of the proposals that are being made in this bill, that through the use of AI, the content should be curated in this way without necessarily needing to have human involvement, because having human moderators is very expensive and it's very time consuming. But using AI and machine learning, you can do this vast amount of censorship almost like instantaneously. There's a whole house bill behind this because there's funding, there's appropriation behind this to create this system for managing the flow of information globally. Very crucially, the world's most popular or the world's most used social media platforms, with the exception of TikTok, are all American. Uh-huh. So Twitter, or you know, X as they call it now, American. Uh-huh. Meta, so that's Facebook, Instagram, Threads, WhatsApp, American. Uh-huh. What's the other one? Snapchat, American. Pretty much all the major ones you can think of. Reddit, American. So the idea is, because the US sort of has this de facto control over the world's information, because most of the world's information is physically domiciled on some server in San Francisco, then the US should start actually using that power to physically dominate people's access to information, right? So, which is something they've always accused, for example, the Chinese of doing, because the Chinese have this internet censorship system called Golden Dawn. Mm-hmm. And it's always been a thing in the US that we're not like the Chinese. We believe in free speech, freedom of expression. Right. We don't censor people. We have a free internet, unlike the Chinese. The Chinese block Google, they block Facebook, they block American platforms. We are free. Mm-hmm. But now the US is pretty much trying to become exactly like China, but possibly worse.
Yeah, they say we have to block information to protect our freedom of information.
Exactly, exactly. We have to kill you to save your life.
Right. And when you say, in your tweet, you said, what if I told you that all of this is written down in granular detail and is publicly accessible? That's what you mean? That House bill?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Okay. One more sort of technical thing here. You say that your African ISP in your African country will soon be subject by 1 or 2 degrees of separation to American laws. What are those 1 or 2 degrees of separation?
So the idea is, in the case of MultiChoice, for example, I know that's not an ISP, it's a TV service, but using the same principle of them having to purchase a feed from a European wholesaler, and in doing so, they then become subject to European or NATO rules, mm-hmm. you know, indirectly, something similar is going to happen with African ISP. So, for example, if you have an internet service provider that is built on a network that uses American infrastructure, so mm-hmm. like, what's the name of this? I believe, is it? No, Motorola is not American, is it? So let's say Siemens. So Siemens is German, but it's a NATO member. So, you know, it'll do. So if, say, your network infrastructure is built on German infrastructure, mm-hmm. and as a NATO member, Germany enforces some new sanctions that make it such that such and such has now been criminalized. What that could mean is, if you need the Germans to come do something, maybe service their equipment, which is a major thing, they mm-hmm. can tell you that except you adhere to such and such, then the contractual agreement has been broken and they no longer will agree to service your stuff and your network will break down. It's a thing. All right. So even though you're not subject to American laws or to European laws, just by virtue of having American and European stuff in your supply chain, you will have no choice but to fall into line. Yeah. Okay. So officially, you're not going to be subject to the US or to Europe, but in effect, that's exactly what you will be, because a lot of this technology is not local. A lot of it is just imported. And in addition to being imported, even like the servicing that keeps it working and serviceable, a lot of it is still like ongoing arrangements with the people it's imported from. It's kind of like buying a plane. So when you buy a plane, you don't own it, right? When you buy a plane, you own the rights to use the plane. But everything that keeps the plane serviceable is pretty much still coming from the people you bought it from. So if you ever fall out with them, then your plane becomes a very expensive piece of scrap metal because you can't fly it anymore. And it's kind of like the same principle with these ISPs, because a lot of this technology, thankfully, a lot of the technology is also built on like Huawei infrastructure, which is Chinese. So it's a lot less likely that China at this point in time is going to weaponize its infrastructure in that way. But the Americans and the Europeans absolutely will. And they have signified that they're willing and ready to do that. So there's going to come a time when either all of Africa is going to have to pivot toward Chinese sort of network infrastructure to avoid having these kinds of problems, or they're going to have to subject themselves through that 1 or 2 degrees of separation to American and European laws, which is exactly what I don't want.
Right. Okay. And at this point, African Stream is still available on the web. You can still go to their website, even if you can't find them on these major social media platforms. But they could make that impossible as well, just as they have made it impossible to get RT in Europe, right?
Yes, they definitely could. Because at the end of the day, you also have to remember that even if you own your own platform, you own your own website, who's hosting it? Is it Amazon? Because if it is, you don't own it. They can take you off at any time, right? All it takes is one court order. Or as we've seen, you might not even need a court order. You might just need Blinken making a statement in front of a microphone, and you just get yanked off.
Okay, so you said this isn't going to work, and you've hinted at why it won't work. Chinese infrastructure is what you've suggested. Could you say more about how this is not going to work?
So think of it like, so that stunt that the Israelis pulled a few days ago, for example, where they blew up a bunch of people's devices remotely, And that was taken as some sort of big win. Wow, we have showed that we can get you wherever you are. Clap, clap, clap. Well, what actually happened in the aftermath was that in the 48 hours after the first attack, not even the second one, the 48 hours after the first attack, Chinese suppliers of such equipment, so smartphones, pagers, walkie-talkies, they couldn't handle the amount of demand that started pouring in from the Arab world. And a lot of these orders, customer orders, large orders that were coming in were based where they had one single instruction. And the instruction was the entire supply chain and manufacturing process has to be domestic in China. So in other words, there has to be no opportunity for like Israeli infiltration into the supply chain. So what that meant was that by pulling that stunt, Israel effectively pivoted a couple of 100 million people. Yeah. Who used Western devices to the Chinese manufacturers. So now they probably haven't seen the impact of this, but probably in a year or two, you will realize that sales of Western electronic products in these markets are going to absolutely fall through the floor. And sales of Chinese electronic products are going to go through the roof. I mean, the Chinese were already very, very competitive and their share of the market was already growing. But now this incredible own goal has basically gift-wrapped an entire market to them. I believe something similar is going to happen when the U.S. starts trying to control information in Africa, because it's what the Americans refer to as the Streisand effect, where in the process of trying to stop people from accessing something, you turn it into forbidden fruit. Then everybody wants to have it.
Yeah, exactly. The U.S. shoots itself in the foot.
Yeah.
Again, it's hard to imagine that they don't see that this is going to happen. But it's going to happen.
Well, large bureaucracies have this funny way of repeating the same mistakes over and over. So if you've read the story of the fall of the Soviet Union, you would see parallels where something clearly is not working, but because it's organizational habits to do this thing, it seems like the organization runs on autopilot and nobody can stop it. I actually think from an American point of view, I mean, I'm not an American, but if I were an American, I would actually be looking forward to having some sort of black swan event that would sort of act as a reset, such that a lot of these fundamental assumptions about U.S. foreign policy and even domestic policy maybe those things can be re-examined, because the U.S. government seems to be this large robot that is operating on autopilot, and nobody can change course, nobody can stop it, nobody can do anything about it, and it's just determined to do what it's going to do. Even if it's going to end up killing itself, that's not going to stop it from doing it.
Exactly. Can't think in terms of anything but U.S. hegemony, at least for now. Okay, David Hundeyan, is there anything else you'd like to say?
What I think is particularly dangerous now is the fact that if you looked at Blinken's, the full transcript of Blinken's press briefing, he referenced how the previous week they had said something about American influencers, YouTubers being used unwittingly to disseminate Russian propaganda. That word unwittingly is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence. And I don't think people understood the implications of what he was saying. Because what he was saying was that these people are not deliberately spreading Russian propaganda, but they're being used without their knowledge. What that means is that anybody can be accused of being a Russian agent unwittingly.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, so once anyone puts out any kind of information which the U.S. government does not approve of, that person can be labeled a Russian operative. And the word unwittingly, as I said, is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that context. I actually think this has been applied to African Stream already, where obviously there's no evidence whatsoever that this thing has anything to do with Russia, because it doesn't have anything to do with Russia. We're a bunch of 25 or 32-year-olds in, you know, CBD Nairobi.
Yeah.
You know, what the hell do we know? What is our problem? What is our interest or involvement in Russia? Because I know this because I've actually worked on site as well. I'm not there presently. Right. I'm not in Kenya presently, but I worked on site. I know this. I know this thing on the back of my hand. So obviously, he knows very well that there is no such thing as Russian involvement with African Stream. But the precedent has been set that you can label even American citizens as Russian operatives and then use the word unwittingly. So if that could be done even to U.S. citizens, then why can't you do it to some, you know, random group of Africans 7,000 miles away who, you know, nobody knows, and in a few weeks everybody's going to forget about them? That's why I think it's a very dangerous thing, because I mean, you're an American, so I'm sure I don't have to tell you about Senator Joe McCarthy and all the things that happened in that period. Dangerous things happen when one person or a tiny group of people have the power to levy such huge accusations against people without needing to provide evidence and without facing any consequence for the accusations. And then these accusations come with consequences. So just being accused of something now leads to a consequence. So little things like proof and due process, those things don't matter anymore. Just the accusation needs to be made. Someone is just throwing out these labels at people and saying they're Russian operatives, and lives are getting ruined because someone is throwing out accusations. That's a very dangerous space that we're in. In addition to being dangerous for U.S. citizens, it's a whole level of danger for those of us who aren't even in the U.S. or from the U.S., because I've never even been to the U.S., right? But my life has been complicated because somebody got on the stage in D.C. and just threw something out there. He didn't need to prove it. He didn't need to even try to prove it. He wasn't interested in trying. He just said something. And because he said something, my life that doesn't coincide with his in any way, 7,000 miles away across the Atlantic, my life then gets complicated. Why is that the case?
Yeah. And in this scenario, Pacifica Radio, which we're talking on, could be deemed to be unwitting to Russian propaganda. Yeah. All of our alternative media sites could. Okay, David Hundeyan, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Nigerian journalist, author, filmmaker, and African Stream contributor, David Hundeyan. You can still find African Stream at their website, africanstream.media, and on X, formerly Twitter, Rumble, Reddit, Patreon, and Telegram. That was Fela Kuti, Zombie. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Anne Garrison. France has sent an aircraft carrier full of troops to the Ivory Coast to confront the newly formed Alliance of the Sahel States. Formed by Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, the Sahel Alliance recently kicked French troops out of their nations, stopped sending uranium to France for pennies on the dollar, left the French interest-dominated ECOWAS alliance of former French colonies, and is working on a joint passport. Black Report Radio's J.R. Valre interviewed the external officer of the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association, Obi Agbuna, about this and other developments in the African world, as well as Cuba and Venezuela.
I just wanted to get an update today for the listeners on some of the things that's happening internationally and in the African world. Most prominently, France recently pulled up with an aircraft carrier and soldiers. Ibrahim Traore, who is the leader of the Burkinabe Revolution, the leader of Burkina Faso, said that the African-European war for uranium is about to begin. Can you give the people an update as well as a history as to what is going on in this time that may lead to war?
Thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. Well, it's ironic that we're having this conversation today, as Saturday was the birthday of Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, the Pan-African champion and giant, Ghana's first president, Ghana being the first nation in sub-Saharan Africa to be free from settler colonialism, breaking the shackles. Since we're talking about this in relationship to the United Nations in the beginning, remember, it was Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah who went beyond the call of duty to say that the United Nations, in addition to the CIA, French intelligence, and Belgian intelligence, was responsible for the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. And I say that because you also have to bring up the Osagyefo when you talk about this alliance, this strategic alliance in the Sahel region between Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, because we would like to salute the leadership of all three nations, because that is a homage, if you will, to the union that was established between Ghana, Guinea, and Mali in 1961. Modibo Keita of Mali, Acme Sekou Touré of Guinea, and Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, they were talking about creating one military, one use of income monetary, and one political party. And that ended up setting the foundation for us to have what's called the Southern African Development Community today, the region for all Southern African nations, COMESA, NAPAD, ECOWAS, and other regional bodies that we have. And that is of paramount importance because we're dealing with the question of security and the question of stability. And President Traore is right. I would only say that the war for uranium continues because when Zimbabwe's armed struggle, the Second Chimurenga, which began in 1966, Ian Smith had already had a plan to tear up what is called the Great Dike by the Rhodesians, and that was the main strategic area in Zimbabwe where the uranium was. And it was only because the armed struggle was ignited, they had to turn their attention to the guerrilla fighters in Zimbabwe. So their quest for our resources, their thirst for our resources, their obsession with our resources goes back centuries.
Recently, there has been a big discussion in the UN, in the United Nations, about giving the 53 nations that make up Africa two security seats. There's a squabble going back and forth. There's debates. What are your thoughts on the two voting security seats for Africa in the United Nations?
Just a platform to magnify contradictions. When I was the U.S. correspondent to the Herald, Zimbabwe's national newspaper, one of my main assignments was to accompany former President Mugabe to the U.N. General Assembly. And you can go back and look at every speech he gave in the 21st century, and he talked about those Security Council seats. But that's a give-and-take development because, as we know, it was Goodluck Jonathan representing Nigeria who went against the African Union's democratic wishes, saying they were against the no-fly zone in Libya. And he went and voted for it when he had a temporary seat. And coincidentally, it was none other than the man who assassinated Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso, Compaoré, who also seconded that motion when they had those temporary seats. So any, regardless of whatever capacity we're in, be we grassroots organizers or heads of state, It's all about us using that platform to magnify contradictions. When we're at the UN, we're in war mode. We're in the mind frame Du Bois was in 1947 when he took an appeal before the United Nations and Eleanor Roosevelt tried to sabotage it, even though she was on the board of directors of the NAACP. We're in the mind frame Malcolm was in when he wanted to take U.S. imperialism before the United Nations. So even when we're in the mind frame Cabral was in when he spoke before them, that Mugabe was in when he spoke before them, that Cuba is in when we speak before them. Whenever we're in the UN, we know that's a question of warfare.
Recently, Africa Stream, which is a very popular revolutionary and progressive platform within the social media world, has been taken off of multiple platforms in a coordinated way. Can you speak to how important it is for African people to address the fact that the United States is afraid of us speaking to our own people and speaking for ourselves with the ability to mobilize and organize?
Imperialism's a three-head monster. No, four-headed. Racism, terrorism, exploitation, and fascism. When they're desperate, they go to fascist measures. Every time we've had a propaganda organ, we'll use it when we're beginning to make leverage. Me, myself, in my capacity as a playwright, one of our poems, the language poem, our people in Burkina Faso, our comrade, Inem Richardson, the director of the Thomas Sankara Center there, she had the children there do a poem we have called the language poem. It's my sister Prudence Tika with the United African Diaspora in Canada, Calgary, Alberta, had children do it. And we had a young brother named Salif Rumak do that with children with a group called African Pride Club. They did it together. So it was done in French, English, and Spanish. And Africa Stream Live was one of the first to play it. An old interview we did showing the history of Africans against Zionist Israel, going beyond Palestinian solidarity, as that's only the tip of the iceberg for that. African Stream Live showed that. So any platform that we have, the enemy's going to take it, but we will come up with another one. That's just the way it goes. When Zimbabwe was fighting their armed struggle, when they were in Mozambique, they used Mozambique to intercept Rhodesian airwaves. Every day for 1 hour, they were able to do that. They had a show called Voice of the Revolution, which resulted in thousands of Zimbabweans crossing over from Zimbabwe into Mozambique to be trained in guerrilla war. So they can take one platform, we'll have another one. But we definitely want to salute those who developed that platform because it was a unique platform. It gave visibility not only to those who articulate ideas, but those who execute ideas. Going back to what Nkrumah taught us, practice without thought is blind, thought without action is empty. So we must stand behind Africa Stream, and if they take that platform from us, we'll come up with another one. And we must create multiple platforms, but put emphasis on organized resistance, which is the most important aspect of the decolonization process, because we must make the quantum leap from victimization to resistance, making that the cornerstone of our narrative.
President Biden has continued the U.S.'s war on Cuba by officially once again extending the Trading with the Enemy Act, a 1917 wartime law that the U.S. only applies to Cuba. The law is a part of the web of sanctions that makes up the embargo. What do you have to say to that?
He's doing what he feels he should do. We have to counter that. And the way we counter that is by pushing back something that he's not ready to deal with, and Kamala Harris isn't ready to deal with, or Donald Trump isn't ready to deal with. And that is to get our sister Asante Shakur off the terrorist list of the Homeland Security and the FBI, get the $2 million bounty off her head, and demand that the U.S. State Department, U.S. imperialism, gets Cuba off that list of nations they accuse of state-sponsored terrorism. They must mistake in Cuba with Zionist Israel, the Congo under Mobutu, Central African Republic under Bukasa, Cote d'Ivoire under Houphouet Boigny, Savimbi and UNITA, RENAMO in Mozambique, and all the neo-colonialist leaders, Traore in Mali, who overthrew Modibo Keita, Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, Somoza in Nicaragua, Papa Doc and Baby Doc in Haiti. That's the way we counter that. The work we're doing around Cuba, we intensify that work. And as a matter of fact, right now, at a time where Cuba has developed a vaccination, which is the only vaccination in this hemisphere that prevents diabetes victims from having their limbs amputated, which is nothing but a slimy capitalist racket, this is the time for the National Medical Association, the Black Nurses Association, and all others who embrace the legacy of those who have fought for us to deal with the healthcare question to raise their voices and come up with action. Every time they attack Cuba, we counter. for not just to look good, but for victory. So the blockade on Cuba must be lifted. The sanctions on Zimbabwe must be lifted. The Sahel region must be left alone. Venezuela must be left alone. All those who embrace their African fighting spirit must be left alone. But that can't be a request that results in the highest level of organization that we can muster at this historical moment.
We see a lot of back and forth going on between the United States and Venezuela, and the United States is trying to cause doubt in their election process that was approved by their governmental hierarchy. It said it was fair. The United States is basically propping up one of its assets. It even went as far as to take President Maduro's plane and stole Maduro's plane. Now Venezuela is about to enter into the BRICS alliance. It is very anticipated that Venezuela will become a part of BRICS, and it will make BRICS an energy giant in the world more than it already is. Can you talk a little bit about the very real war, but as well as the economic war that's going on between the United States and Venezuela at this current time?
We congratulate our comrades in Venezuela for the conference that they just had, exposing fascism, exposing capitalism, exposing exploitation, and the different methods that U.S. imperialism is using. We know Venezuela was very serious from the moment that the late Comandante Hugo Chavez gave President Mugabe of Zimbabwe the Bolivar Award, which is patterned after Cuba's Martí Award. As far as President Maduro goes, all these conversations about democracy are laughable, because if you know President Maduro's history, he was a bus driver. And how does a bus driver become a president of a nation unless he is truly one with his people? Venezuela is also a threat because of the Afro-Cumbe movement, which is a movement of Afro-descendants throughout the Americas, challenging us to reject what the Democrats and Republicans, in their very Hitleristic, Mussolini-like way, when they declare their America, acting like North America represents South America, Central America, Latin America, the Caribbean, which is so fascist it would make Mussolini and Hitler envious. The other reason Venezuela is under attack, because Venezuela, in its capacity as part of the ALBA Nations, Bolivarian Alliance of our Americas, let it be known that the United States Agency for International Development, created in 1961 when the Peace Corps was created in 1961, right around the same time that the Bay of Pigs invasion, the failed cowardly invasion in Cuba failed, blew up in their faces. What happened was this organization is the humanitarian face of imperialist ventures. And Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Bolivia, Haiti, and Suriname said that their offices should be shut down all over the Americas. Putin expelled them from Russia. And Afwerki in Eritrea was the first one in Africa way back in 2005 to kick them off the African continent. So that right there put Venezuela in hot water. And they are only doing the same thing to Venezuela's elections that they tried to do to Zimbabwe's elections, where the National Endowment for Democracy, the National Democratic Institute, and the International Republican Institute, three propaganda organs, attempt to use their propaganda to diminish the value of authentic elections by indigenous forces who do not accept their money and do not accept their input. The other reason that Venezuela is a threat to them is because they know that eventually, if Venezuela is able to convince Africans in the Americas, we shouldn't look at ourselves as African-Americans, Afro-Latino, Afro-Caribbean. We are just stolen Africans, like the comedian Paul Mooney used to say, that consolidates Africa's efforts in this hemisphere. You say you're talking about a contingent of 230 million Africans potentially, which would put us in the neighborhood with Nigeria population-wise if we begin to move that way politically, and like the Africans in Brazil and the Africans in Australia. This is what they're afraid of. So standing with Venezuela is very important, especially for those of us who are Africans. That's why we've always worked very closely with the Venezuelans and will continue to do so.
That was Obi Agbuna, External Officer of the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association, speaking to J.R. Valerie of Block Report Radio.
Here I am. trapped by fear. I'm in a box. I've got no place to go. If I follow my mind, I know I slaughter my own. Help me, I'm the prisoner. Won't you hear my plea? I need somebody, yeah, to listen to me. I beg you, brothers and sisters, I'm counting on you,
That was Gil Scott-Heron, The Prisoner. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. On September 25, federal judge Benita Pearson in Youngstown, Ohio, approved a $600 million settlement in the East Palestine Norfolk Southern train derailment. The settlement proposal does not cover health care or compensation for the residents to move out of their contaminated homes. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke to Jamie Ray Wallace, a retired SEIU 1199 member and one of the founders of the Unity Council for East Palestine Derailment, which has exposed the collusion between the Biden administration, Norfolk Southern Railway, the EPA, and the Department of Transportation. The Biden administration has refused to declare East Palestine a Superfund site or a mass casualty incident. Under the Federal Stafford Act, residents are entitled to health care and funds to move out of their homes.
There's been a cover-up since day one. I feel like the EPA has been covering up information. Their own inspector general did an investigation early on where they showed that the EPA gave the residents reason not to trust them. One of the things that they had done is messed up some test results that they posted online by a decimal point, you know, which in this situation, a decimal point could mean the difference between life and death. They messed up when they did air testing of our homes. The equipment that they used couldn't test for all contaminants of concern, nor could it test for other contaminants at low enough levels, levels that were okay to live in. We've just watched mistake after mistake by the EPA from the very beginning. So I don't know why I expected any more from the federal judge that was appointed to this class action. I've watched my community be deceived by the lead counsel for the plaintiffs. These attorneys are supposed to be working in the best interest of the community, yet they had test results from an expert that they hired that they buried. Instead, they decided to find a toxicologist who had worked for Dow Chemicals, Exxon, Chevron, and a couple of energy companies in the past to get on a town hall and to tell residents that there would be no long-term health effects and that there would be no cases of cancer related to the chemical exposure from the derailment. When this was brought up in the courtroom yesterday, the judge didn't even address it. Residents that opted in with objection, when those letters were due back on the 1st of July, residents were told to include whether or not they wanted to testify at the hearing. No residents were asked to testify at the hearing. There are lead plaintiffs that are supposed to represent the interests of the community. A lot of them have lied about who they are when asked. Others, you know, I've never seen any of them at any of the EPA community meetings, at the CDC meetings. I've never talked to any of them. You know, a lot of other residents will say, I've never personally talked to them. So how are they representing the class? I don't even know that any of those who were part of the lead plaintiffs even were relocated from their homes.
When this incident took place, this so-called accident by Norfolk Southern, apparently the EPA went there and, first of all, they didn't contact all the residents, but they did tell people they could return to their homes. There wasn't a danger. Is that true?
True. The federal government says that the EPA was on the ground within hours of the derailment. Yet somehow Norfolk Southern was able to just cover up all this contamination and build their tracks and start moving their trains. How the EPA didn't see that if they were on the ground, or did they purposefully allow this so that they could get these tracks back up and running? They had to lift the evacuation or the trains couldn't come through. The trains cannot travel through an evacuated community. So the EPA prematurely said it was okay to come back. We've shown that time and time again by now. And, you know, we were just told that it was safe and it wasn't. My own home, you know, I knew as soon as I pulled in my driveway and couldn't breathe and look over and there's chemicals flowing down my creek, it wasn't safe to be at my house. You know, my own house, the railroad's toxicologist came in back in February of 2023 and said it was contaminated. So if I had just blindly taken my child home and not thrown a fit, she would have been continually exposed to these chemicals and even possibly died from it. Like I said, from the beginning, we've been pushed over by every single agency that has come to East Palestine, and every single action that has been taken, we've had to fight for, whether it was cleaning up the tracks, whether it was dioxin testing, making sure our creeks were clean. This was all citizen pressed issues. It wasn't something that was being done because it should have been done. It was being done because we wouldn't shut up.
And one of the things I learned from an interview yesterday was that one of the companies that Norfolk Southern hired to do the testing of the streams was Tetra Tech. And I know that Tetra Tech was involved in a massive cover-up in San Francisco, Hunters Point Shipyard and Treasure Island. Over $1 billion was spent, and they committed fraud in the remediation. And two of their lower-level managers actually went to federal prison. Yet Norfolk Southern hired this company. Is there a connection between the cover-up going on in San Francisco and what they're doing in East Palestine?
I think it's a systemic issue with this particular company and their testing. And they probably know, just like the scientists that work for all the big polluters, that if you're a big polluter and you want someone to push out the narrative that everything's fine, that this particular company is willing to do that.
In the course of this struggle to protect the residents, there have been toxicologists, inspectors that have come to the community and to do inspections, independent inspections. Who are these people and what did they try to present at the hearing yesterday?
Well, we have some independent testers that have come in to help us in the community. We've had various people come in. We had Andrew Welton come in from Purdue University. He's getting ready to publish his book. We have had Scott Smith, who is an independent tester who has done an extensive amount of testing that goes directly against the narrative that's trying to be painted by the EPA. He's been to, I think, like 60 different disasters. The EPA has said that he's qualified to take these samples, but yet the EPA tried to attack his credibility. You know, it's just kind of funny that at one point in Flint, Michigan, the EPA is agreeing, oh, this guy's good, his testing is good. And now all of a sudden, when it goes against the narrative that everything is okay, you know, he's not qualified. We have George Thompson, who has come in. He was an independent chemical expert. I guess he was like contracted out for years. He came out of retirement to come out and speak on East Palestine and to help bring awareness to how big this disaster was. And then Stephen Petty, he was the scientist. He's one of the lead dioxin experts in the world. And he was hired by the lead counsel of the class action to do testing in East Palestine. And they actually suppressed his information and he is still not allowed to release it. So both Scott Smith and Stephen Petty, and I believe Dr. Thompson also, submitted affidavits to the court a couple of days before this final hearing, explaining to them the information that they had found. And the judge basically ignored it.
So you're saying that this federal judge, even though these affidavits from experts, toxicology experts, said that there's serious health hazards. And one of the things that George Thompson has said is that the combination of these chemicals, vinyl chloride with other chemicals, creates even additional hazards for health of the community members. Because when the chemicals mix, then you get new problems as far as new chemical reactions. So the judge did not even question their report and also did not ask the Norfolk Southern about these issues?
No. The judge just basically went on with the hearing and acted like none of this stuff was ever brought up or said. You know, it just shows the judge's attitude. I believe that she already had her mind made up of what she was going to say when she walked into that room. And, you know, at the end, I was upset. Like, I'm very upset that, you know, these attorneys that are supposed to represent the community, you know, used PR tactics to try to deceive them, told them there'd be no long-term health risk. You know, all of these things that was told to this judge, and she just ignored it. And as she, you know, gave her ruling without even taking a minute to think about it, I was walking out the door and I yelled, "This is a sham. Our own attorneys lied to us." And the judge yells to her security to put me on the pavement. That shows how much we've had a voice in this as, you know, the plaintiffs in this case. The judge didn't want to hear from us. The lead counsel never contacted anybody in the community asking for evidence that we had, testing, health problems, nothing. This was not done in the best interest of the community. It was done in the best interest of pocketbooks. And exactly what you just said, Steve, is the elephant in the room. You know, these reportable limits that the EPA is talking about, it's based on single chemical exposure. So we say, okay, here's the, you know, the limit of vinyl chloride that you can be in for extended periods of time. But they only subjected that subject to the vinyl chloride. What happens if you have all these chemicals together? Like you said, even if they're below those reportable limits, you know, not only do you have the burden on your body of all these different chemicals at once, but they also interact in certain ways. I guess the easiest way to explain that is, you know, there's a lot of medications that you're not supposed to eat grapefruit with, or, you know, caffeine and aspirin together cure a migraine, but separately they do nothing for a migraine. There's zero research on that. And that's why it's so important, not only for East Palestine residents, but for the entire country, for anyone living within 30 miles of railroad tracks to support this type of research. Again, we've been abandoned by our state government, by the federal government. You know, we've been screwed every step along the way. And yesterday was just another example of how they're doing nothing for us.
That was Jamie Ray Wallace from East Palestine talking with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer about the recent federal court approval of a settlement of the East Palestine rail catastrophe. The Justice for East Palestine Residents and Workers Coalition has planned a rally on October 18th at the Ohio EPA office to demand that President Biden implement the Stafford Act. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from J.R. Valray, Steve Seltzer, Paulina Vasiliev, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.